Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of October. Our guest has written a highly acclaimed book that's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 11 weeks now, and it started with this creative experiment. Suppose that the worst has happened. Human extinction is a fait accompli, not by nuclear calamity, asteroid collision, or anything ruinous enough to also wipe out most everything else, leaving whatever remained in some radically altered, reduced state. Picture a world from which we all suddenly vanished tomorrow. Thus, his book, and it's so fascinating, The World Without Us. Alan Weisman is our guest. He traveled all over the world and found some extraordinary things. He went to the demilitarized zone in South Korea. He went to Cyprus. He went to the Amazon. He went to Chernobyl and to a pristine forest that's been around for some 500 years in Belarus. And he's written just this, I mean, it's just a thriller, just a really interesting book. Well, he's going to be with us in just one moment. But before we get to him, we are in our pledge drive. It's the first day of the pledge drive. Rhonda Fanning, our wonderful producer, is here. We have a goal and we want to let you know how you can join this conversation, pledge, get the book, feel good about the whole thing. And Rhonda, good morning. Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. It is a pledge drive. You can log on to WPR.org or give one of our wonderful volunteers a call at 800-383-9772. This hour goal is $3,000. And like Kathleen said, we will be joined by Alan Weisman momentarily to talk about his very engaging book, The World Without Us. But I wanted everyone to imagine what the world of public radio would be without
Rhonda,
you.
Oh, Rhonda, I
listener.
Like that line. Very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
I came up with that just on my own. without you and your contribution, public radio would cease to exist. So please, during this program, log onto your computers, WPR.org, or give us a call at 800-383-9772.
And for those of you who pledge at the $150 level,
you,
we need to tell you that you're going to be so happy that you did, because you'll be able to get this book, The World Without Us, for $150 pledge. And it's one of those books you can't put down. He's a scientist. He wanted to be a scientist, but he's also an extraordinary journalist. And so the writing is very, very interesting. The whole premise of the book is interesting, too. What will last? What wouldn't last? Is everything going to go down the tubes? What happens to New York City is really interesting. Well, the whole book is interesting. So for a pledge of $150, then you can get the book. You'll have a great read, and you'll be able to ensure that public radio will continue. That you won't have to worry about a world
this
without
conversation.
Us.
This hour's goal at $3,000, so let's get the show started. Log on, WPR.org, or 800-383-9772.
Thanks very much, Rhonda. Mm-hmm. Rhonda Fanning, our wonderful producer of this program, and we're going to be speaking with Alan Weisman now in just a moment. And welcome phone calls for him as well. Our on-air number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Alan Weisman is the author of The World Without Us. He is an award-winning journalist whose reports have appeared in Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, Discover, and also on National Public Radio. He's a former contributing editor to the LA Times Magazine, is senior radio producer for Homelands Productions, and teaches international journalism at the University of Arizona. His essay, Earth Without People, which was in Discover Magazine, February of 2005, was selected for Best American Science Writing from 2000 to 2007, and the book expands on that essay. And a fascinating book it is. Alan, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Isn't it amazing when you think about it? You asked that question, and look where it took you, Alan. You were all over the world.
Well, it's a question that opened up my imagination, and as I went all over the world asking experts, eyewitnesses, people on the ground, what would happen if you removed human beings? What would happen if you removed yourself from this?
Mm-hmm.
It opened up their imaginations, and that seems to be happening to readers as well.
Yeah, it sure does. As a boy, you write, you always wanted to be a scientist, but you could never figure out what kind because everything interested you. So you found really the perfect career for yourself, didn't you?
I would recommend journalism to anybody who's either so curious about everything that they can't make a decision or wants to do everything. And if you can't, the next best thing is to poke your nose into what all these interesting people are doing.
Yes, exactly. Well, I don't know where we should start in the world. Maybe we should start with Poland's and Belarus's ancient forests, which you say in the book you felt like you were entering holy ground, and it's a pilgrimage you wish every European might make. I didn't even know about it. What is it? Why should everybody make this pilgrimage?
Well, you know, to give a little background, I mean, this book theoretically wipes human beings off the map to see what else, you know, is here on Earth. You know, we could see them a lot better without all of our distractions. And we could see how would those things flourish without all of our daily pressures that we're constantly heaping on them, and how would it deal with the stuff that we would leave behind, everything from all the stuff that we've built to things like all the carbon that we have pumped up our chimneys, how long would it take for that to settle down? To get a sense of this world, I did, you know, it's kind of like the authors of Genesis did. You know, you start out in something that all of us sort of innately senses was once here, and that's kind of paradise. And there is a fragment of original old-growth European forest left on the Polish-Belarusian border. It was reserved in the 14th century by a Lithuanian duke who married the Queen of Poland, and then a succession of Polish kings and Russian czars kept this as their royal hunting preserve. Very few people could enter into it. And even during the Nazi era, Hermann Göring, who apparently was a big nature fanatic.
Really?
Yeah, he kept it private. And following World War II, apparently some Polish scientists got Joseph Stalin drunk in Warsaw and convinced him to make it a Polish national park. Or it was, you know, within the Soviet orbit then. And it has stayed that way. The pristine core of this thing, I liken it to that forest that we would all see in our mind's eye when we'd hear Grimm's fairy tales as children. And it's utterly remarkable to see versions of the northern temperate forest, like grow in Wisconsin, only gigantic examples of those trees. And yet what's incredible about it is that it doesn't seem so strange. It seems oddly familiar, like our bodies remember what it used to be like.
Hmm. Will it stay that way or not?
Well, in right now, the Polish government and the Belarusian government each are kind of chipping in closer and closer to the center, and you get all these forestry management experts who talk about how we can help manage the forest to maintain its primeval qualities and help it survive. And yet, these forests have been surviving by themselves really, really well without our intervention, and that intervention is oftentimes a euphemism for going in there and culling and thinning and taking something precious out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if human beings were not around, this forest would start spreading. It would start occupying the surrounding agricultural land, much of which is already happening because a lot of that land is being abandoned. A small farming is being abandoned in Poland. You know, my book leaves a lot of open questions. It shows some tantalizing visions of what could happen if we just let nature alone to do what it does so very well.
Yeah, exactly. I was really interested in what war does to the land, and you talk about how obviously with chemicals and what's put in the ground, it can be a force for horrible destruction, but it also, and you talk about the Contra war in Nicaragua and also what's happened to the demilitarized zone, which most of us have no idea how it is flourishing. There are birds there that haven't been there for years and years.
Yeah, I went to, I talk about a few examples of war. Vietnam, of course, where we used Agent Orange, is one of the most devastating environmental insults that we have ever hurled at this planet. And those lands may take hundreds of years for the plants that come in now to lay down enough topsoil, you know, enough organic material that what used to grow there could come back. Ironically, though, in some places, getting people out of the way during war, stopping their activities really helps. In Nicaragua, during the Contra War, the lobster beds and the shrimp beds and the over-harvested timber reserves all really bounced back because there were 8 years nobody was exploiting them. In the Korean that has been allowed to revert to wilderness on either side. You've got two of the world's most hostile armies, and some of the most precious endangered species in all of Asia now are finding shelter there. And the bird that I talk about in this book is the red-crowned crane. It is, next to the whooping crane, the rarest crane on Earth. There's only about 1,100 of them left, and most of them winter in the demilitarized zone. So oddly enough, this suspended state of war is what gives them a habitat. And, you know, it's this beautiful bird that we've all seen in so much Oriental art. And it's really remarkable. I should say that the impetus to turn the demilitarized zone into an international peace park to preserve these birds and many other species that live there, much of that comes out of the state of Wisconsin, the International Crane Foundation.
Oh,
and Baraboo
yes.
Huh. Has done magnificent work, and they've gone repeatedly to the DMZ to try to get people to understand the value of this place.
Interesting. One of the wonderful things, and your acknowledgments at the end of the book are an entire chapter in themselves, because when you think about answering the question that you posed for the framework of the book, it takes you to all kinds of extraordinary people, to scientists and to people who work in petroleum areas, and it takes you to visionaries and to population control experts. Just there are a lot of people that you talk to help you figure your way through this book, right?
Yeah, it's kind of an odd paradox. In order to write a book about what the world would be like without people in it, required this huge cast of expert characters to inform this reporter.
Mm-hmm. New York City. Let's go to New York, because we all conjure up these images of the huge buildings and all the bustling people and shops, etc. New York City would flood pretty soon.
Yeah, you know, after I take people to this forest primeval to show, you know, how nature could be if we weren't banging on it all the time, I have to talk about, well, you know, how have we managed to wall ourselves off and separate ourselves from the rest of nature? So I literally start with tearing down these walls, and there's a chapter about how our individual houses would come down if we weren't maintaining them all the time. But but to really show it, you have to look at one of our big urban landscapes, which we think of as so dominating on the landscape, and New York is kind of the epitome. And it turns out, though, that these places have their vulnerabilities, and they really depend on human beings as well to take care of them. Subway engineers took me underneath the city to show me that, basically, it was once a much hillier city, and it had a lot of streams and rivers that would drain rainfall off to the sea. But then all those hills got mashed down when they superimposed the city grid. Mm. The rivers got buried, and even though a sewer system was put in, it can never do as efficiently what nature naturally does. So these guys have got to keep nearly 800 pumps going a day to pump water out of the subway tunnels, lest it flood them. And if they weren't there, or if no one were in the power plants, within 2 or 3 days, the subways would flood, which would then lead to cascade of events. So the steel columns holding up the streets would start to corrode, rust, eventually crumble within a couple of decades. The steel foundations that anchor a lot of Manhattan skyscrapers to the bedrock, they were not built to be waterlogged, and this would cause a lot of structural instability. Eventually, an unstable skyscraper hit by a hurricane will topple over just like a big tree in the forest and knock down a few other things with it. And then just think of all the clogged sewers, because all those plastic bags that would find their way there, and leaf litter would collect in the streets, and it would be a nice wet medium for seeds to germinate, and then no one's raking them up, so fire will eventually pass through. A succession of events will bring back a mature forest in Manhattan.
Those plastic bags, those bits of plastic that would be clogging the oceans, plastic would remain long after we were gone.
Yeah, plastic, it's sort of the newest hydrocarbon on the block, and of course we've added other things to it like chlorine and sulfur to make different kinds of plastics, and we don't have microbes capable of digesting it yet. It took microbes a long time to learn how to digest lignin in trees. This is what one of the plastic experts explained to me, which is why so many trees, instead of decaying, just got buried and eventually got compressed to form coal. And you can see the wood grain when you go into the coal mine. Mm. Plastics will also enter the geologic record because it's going to take probably hundreds of thousands of years for stuff to learn how to fully digest all that out there. But in the meantime, because it is so light, a lot of it doesn't take geologic time to erode and wash to the sea. A lot of it is blowing on the wind or flowing in gutters and streams and finding its way seaward. And there are huge rafts out in our oceans, size of small continents, that are floating around with it.
Oh, my gosh. The size of small continents?
Yeah. The one in the Pacific, at first they were likening it to the size of Texas, and now they're saying it's approaching the size of Africa. There's a lot of plastic out there, the massive plastic in these floating gyres exceeds by a factor of 6 in some cases the amount of plankton material out there. And wave action is breaking up plastic. You know, just like when plastic will break up under ultraviolet rays, you leave a sheet of plastic out on the ground, it's just breaking it into smaller pieces. The plastic isn't going away. The polymer chains are turning into smaller polymer chains. And in the oceans, wave action is creating smaller pieces of plastic that's being ingested by smaller and smaller creatures.
Mm.
And, this is an unintended consequence that could have some big repercussions for us.
Mm-hmm. What about our finest creations, our architecture, art, as you call them, the many manifestations of spirit? Would any remain?
Yeah, some things will stick around for a long time. I mean, I mentioned in the house chapter, your bathroom tile is going to last longer than about everything else you have in your house, and it's a ceramic. It's very close to, as the materials experts explained, its lowest energy state, down there being like a rock. So our ceramic art, if it doesn't get crushed, it will last as long as the earth around it lasts, which is kind of nice to think of. One of our most durable man-made materials is an alloy called bronze. And that's why we know about the Bronze Age. If it wasn't melted down for metals, it's probably still around in the form that the sculptor created. And that's kind of beautiful to think of, some of these wonderful things that Rodin has done. We'll succeed it. Our radio waves, this discussion that we're having, it's going away at the speed of light, and it'll become more diffuse as it goes farther and farther out in space. But there are traces of us that will continue. And as for architecture, it turns out that the oldest stuff that we have ever created, stuff made out of the earth itself, stone buildings, think Machu Picchu, they will last much longer than our newest architecture. At one point, I go to a seaside resort that was built in the 70s on the island of Cyprus and then unfortunately got abandoned and kind of orphaned during the Cyprus Civil War. It's sort of stuck in the Cyprus DMZ as well, and there haven't been human beings in there for 33 years, but nature has just gone in there, and these reinforced concrete hotels with balconies hanging over the ocean, not one of them is salvageable at this point. There are trees growing right up out of the rooftops, and sand is filling the lobbies, and animals roosting. The newer architecture does not last very long unless we're maintaining it. But steel reinforcing bar, when it rusts, the rust expands and it just starts crumbling that concrete.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Alan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. We'll also talk about more self-healing when would CO2 levels return to pre-human levels? What about nuclear power plants? He spent some time around Chernobyl, too, where there is still wildlife. It's an interesting chapter in the book. And Well, we have much more to talk about with Alan. 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the book, which has been many, many weeks now on the New York Times bestseller list, is a fascinating read. It is titled The World Without Us, and it is just about that. What would happen if humanity might suddenly disappear? We should also tell you we're in a pledge drive. It's the first day of our pledge drive. So for those of you who pledge $150, we'll be very happy to send you a copy of Alan's book, The World Without Us. And you can pledge at 800-383-9772, 800-383-9772. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alan Weissman is our guest, and his book is The World Without Us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In 1950, there were 150 million people in the United States. Now we have 300 million. And in 1950, there were 2.5 billion people on the face of the Earth. Now we've got six headed towards seven. We are using up the Earth's resources. Another thing, we are running out of water nationwide and worldwide. Cities here in the United States, and Atlanta, Georgia, is one that I can think of, has a very acute shortage of water. And we have got to do something and do something immediately. We have environmental problems that are starting to hit us right in the face.
You take on the issue of population in a big way. It's of deep concern to you, Alan, isn't it?
Well, you know, one of the reasons this book has had such huge acceptance is that I don't, throughout the entire book, until the very last couple pages, I don't give any suggestions of what we should do. I just let the facts speak for themselves. That's what a journalist is supposed to do. This is not a screed, and I've really been pleased to be sympathetically welcomed on many conservative talk radio shows because, you know, this book is not preaching or making people feel guilty. But at the very end, the facts kind of lead to something that is very obvious, and that is it's not just what we do, but it's the numbers of us who are doing it. Mm-hmm. Every 4 days, we're increasing by a million people.
Isn't that amazing to think about? Every 4 days, a million people.
Yeah. That's a lot of people. I mean, yeah. The listener is absolutely correct. And, you know, at the end of the 19th century, there were 1.6 billion of us. Today, there's 6.6 billion of us. We're headed to 9 billion, et cetera. So at the end of the book, you know, this whole thing has been kind of a thought experiment. You know, what if suddenly we just vanished? How would nature get along without us? But I really am not advocating the demise of the human race, as some people do, and I interview some of them for this book. I would like us to stick around. I think that we deserve to be here like any other species. We just need to find our proper balance with the rest of nature. Otherwise, not only are we going to run everything else off, but we're going to undermine our own resource foundation. And every creature in the history of biology that ever exceeds its resource base suffers a bad population crash. We're headed for one. The question is, do we want to let nature just do it to us, or do we want to try to manage it and bring it down in kind of a humane way? So I pose another thought experiment at the end, which is, well, what if we do continue on this planet, but, and I know this is an uncomfortable thought, it certainly is for me, but what if we limited ourselves just to one offspring from now on? And I got some demographic institutes in Europe to run the numbers for me. It's kind of too volatile a subject these days in the United States. It's rather interesting to find that out. And it turns out that within a century, just through attrition, we would bring ourselves back down to those 19th century population figures, 1.6 billion. And maybe those are numbers that we could all live with. Granted, this would not be easy. It goes against a lot of our natural impulses, the natural impulse of any species. But if we pride ourselves on being able to be, you know, the one species that can see or envision the future results of our actions, maybe it's time to start find some wisdom and to act upon that.
I want you to comment on, we have to get this guy on for a talk show, too. You talk with Les Knight, the founder of the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, a collective refusal to procreate After initial panic, we would look around and see that the world was actually getting better with no more human, with no more resource conflicts. He says, I doubt we'd be wasting each other's lives in combat so the last humans could enjoy their final sunsets peacefully, knowing they returned the planet as close as possible to the Garden of Eden. Is that the likely scenario, do you think?
Well, you know, Les is a very thoughtful, sincere, and articulate guy, and it was very, very helpful for me to talk to him and see his vision. I understand there's a movie out there that shows that, you know, some similar scenario, like human beings are fighting like crazy at the end. His vision was that as there were fewer and fewer of us over succeeding decades, if human beings stopped procreating altogether, that the world would just turn wilder and more beautiful because there were less human beings out there messing it up. And it was really him that got me to thinking, well, you know, there's probably something to that. It's kind of what my book is about. Without human beings, nature would heal itself, even in some very contaminated places. But isn't there some way that we could still be here and be part of this, only in some much better balance, much more harmony with the rest of nature? And that's what got me to inquire of these population institutes, you know, what would happen if we radically reduced our population. Now, I understand, you know, some people really recoil. I mean, you know, I'm the second child in my family. I wouldn't be here if this was going on.
That's right.
Also,
yeah.
You know, in China, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, that experiment was a disaster. Well, on some levels, it absolutely was. I mean, but it, as experiments should do, they show us up. They show us some of the unanticipated results. The cultural discrimination against female babies, we now know that that would happen in a lot of cultures, but there are ways to work with that. And, you know, one of the ways is that we now have this beautiful sprinkling of Chinese girls growing up in North America because people are now alerted to the fact that if they're unwanted there, then people who don't have children here or would like to have more than one children but don't want to keep procreating will willingly take them. So this is going to involve a lot of complicated stuff, everything mm-hmm. in human society does. But I think it's something that we have to be thinking about. It's a conversation we have to have. And yes, I know there are religious constrictions, but on the other hand, Italy has lowered its population rate almost down to one child per family. And, you know, this is, shall we say, a very Catholic country.
Mm-hmm.
They have worked with that. It should be pointed out that Italy has one of the world's highest rate of female PhDs. So educate women, and they tend to defer childbearing until they finish their educations, and that naturally lowers population.
Right. Thanks, Eugene, so much for your call. We go to Terry from Verona next. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
I, first of all, wanted to say thank you so much for your book. It's just fantastic. Many times I've been walking through cities, and I've been looking at weeds popping up through sidewalks and wondering how long it would take for the buildings to degrade.
Hmm.
And I, with regard to your discussion of population reduction, I think, you know, that's undeniably where we're going to have to be headed to be able to continue to survive. But I think that we also have to try to take back some of the material we've put out there. And so my question was, with regard to that giant swirling vortex of plastics that are in the oceans, I'm wondering if you looked into whether, either now or in the future, there would be any ability to harvest those and reuse them.
Well, very good question, Terry. I did not look into that. It's, you know, there are dredges. It's one of the ways that they know how much is out there is that they go out there and they sample, you know, by dragging something behind. And the problem is that a lot of this stuff is breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces. And then, you know, you need finer and finer filters, and some of it gets algae clogged and it starts sinking. And I think what's eventually going to happen is that most of it will finally find its way towards the bottom, and then there's a problem because there are bottom feeders in a lot of the oceans, you know, filter feeders all the way down through the water column. We're going to be stuck with most of the stuff that's already escaped us. However, we could be very, very quickly reversing lightweight. There's a lot of good applications. But the overwhelmingly problematic application has to do with food packaging. And we used to not use this stuff for food packaging. It didn't really begin to be food packaging until right after World War II.
Hmm.
And so just think about when your grandmother went to market. She did not put the apples in one bag and the tomatoes in another bag and the onions in another bag, et cetera, and so forth. She brought a bag from home. She filled it up. She took it home. She dumped it out. And she probably used that same bag over and over and over again. And today, you know, there's this moral decision that we're confronted with, paper or plastic.
It turns right.
Paper is not that great either, because even though it is biodegradable, if you bury it in a landfill away from oxygen, it doesn't degrade. Archaeologists are reading 100-year-old newspapers down there, you know, who are excavating our landfills.
Hmm.
So when people have asked me, you know, what can we do? I say, you know, tell your legislators, call your legislators, call your congresspeople and say, will you introduce a bill in the legislature or in Congress making it a crime to give away a free bag in a supermarket? And believe me, if that were the case, we would remember to bring the same bag over and over again. I mean, it's fine. And a lot of supermarket chains are starting to sell really nice insulated bags made out of recycled plastic, and you'll use them over and over again if you charge for them. So
right.
That's something we can do right now.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. How long would it take for, you know, we're dealing with this global warming issue and the CO2 in the air. How long would it take, if ever? Would it ever go away, Alan?
Well, I guess it will go away. The world, the Earth, absorbs carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in three ways. The ocean absorbs a lot of it, the biological systems, of course. Plants absorb it, and even the geological systems, you know, eventually, you know, rain dissolves it, it falls as carbonic acid, it combines with rocks, and precipitates out later on in the form of seashells. That, I am told by, I've talked to various atmospheric scientists, the best estimate that I got that seemed to average everything is that it'll take about 100,000 years for all the carbon we've already sent up into the atmosphere that we've dug out, that nature had stored away because it didn't need it. 100,000 years for it to return to pre-industrial levels.
Hmm.
But most of that would happen in the first 1,000 years. The ocean is the most powerful absorber, and it turns over in 1,000 years. And so after a few centuries, we'd start to see really a notable decrease in the amount of carbon dioxide. I mean, that's assuming that tomorrow we stop sending the stuff up. And of course, we're not doing that now. Pre-industrial revolution, 280 parts per million. We're at about 380 parts per million now, and we're already starting to see that most people are pretty convinced, you know, except for a diehard few out there who make a lot of money getting, you know, giving speeches
right.
saying that this is not a problem or not a man-made problem.
Right.
You know, we're seeing a lot of impacts. And scientists and environmental activists that I was talking to just a few years about this were saying, well, we hope we can hold it at 500 parts per million. I mean, that's considerably more than we've got right now. I'm kind of concerned about that. But one thing that the research for this book has taught me, I came into this thing very, very concerned about the fate of the Earth, and I no longer really am. The planet does just fine. Life does just fine. It's been through incredible cataclysms in the past, even before we were here, you know, huge extinctions because of enormous volcanic eruptions or asteroids that struck the Earth, and life keeps coming back in amazing ways. So life will go on. The Earth will go on. The question is, will life as we know it and will we ourselves continue to go on? And that's what I'm hoping for. I'm not ready to leave yet.
I know. I'm not either. I think many of us are. Let's take another phone call for you. David from Whitefish Bay. Hi, David.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Alan.
Hi.
I'm an old backpacking companion of yours.
Oh, my.
We went backpacking in Arizona, supposedly exploring a virgin canyon.
Oh.
Years ago.
Was it Escalante or was it Dark Canyon? Where were
no, it was at Burrow Creek.
Oh, goodness.
A canyon that supposedly no non-Native Americans had ever explored. And, of course, as you remember, in the bottom of the canyon, we found a marijuana plantation.
Well, there was that. Yes, David, I remember well. That was an extraordinary place.
Yeah, and I expect just as we were surprised by that artifact of human civilization, despite your very comprehensive and great analysis of the world without humans, there will probably be surprises like that.
Hmm. Well, you know, at one point I was a scientist in New York Botanical Garden where they have in the Bronx a 40-acre area that's uncut.
Oh,
old
yes.
Growth. And yet there are all these plants that have invaded, just, you know, ornamental plants that have blown in from the Bronx and seeded themselves. And this guy mentions to me, as a botanist from there, says, you know, it's not really that bad when you realize that what's really important is to have a functioning ecosystem, that you will have you know, plants that are filtering the air and filtering the water and holding the soil in place. He said, in my career, I have been in the jungles of Burma where you find these groves of tea trees growing, or durian fruit trees in Indonesia, or palm nut trees in Brazil. Those are not there by accident. Once there were human societies there, too, the wilderness has swallowed them up, and we don't see any traces of them except for these echoes that have now become part of the wilderness itself. And I think that that's what we, you know, are going to be looking at with the remnants of what we have left, be it cannabis plants or be it some of the ornamentals that we have brought over from the Orient that now, or, you know, the bougainvillea that's in the south that came up from Brazil. I mean, this is now part of a natural ecosystem that nature will take some of the stuff that we've done and shape it into something beautiful.
Hmm. Thanks so much. Let's take just one more phone call. Mark from Green Bay. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
Yeah, on the point that you just made, this is exactly what I've been thinking about with the Great Lakes, and I'm wondering if you see any desire on the part of ecologists or DNRs from various states to take a hands-off approach. And we've already goofed up the system. Why not just stand back and see what it does on its own for 100 years?
Well, you know, I think there's some good arguments on that side. I think there's also some great concerns that some of the stuff that we have introduced, if there's still a chance to beat it back before it wipes out some native species that big chunks of the ecosystem depend on. I mean, I talk in my book about purple loosestrife, which is a beautiful plant. It has purple stalks that came in ballast in colonial ships that were, you know, bringing products to America. And it invaded like the Hudson River system, and now it's spread all the way across to Alaska, and it's displaced a lot of the natural foliage that a lot of our ducks and geese and other, you know, animals that live around marshes depend on. In the Great Lakes system, you know, there's issues with things like zebra mussels, and, you know, people that they've been fighting lampreys for years. You know, ultimately, that these may be losing battles, and then the ecosystems will change, and they will go on to something else. We're losing a lot of our western forests now because drought is changing them. They're giving bark beetles, which have been resident for a long time, the chance to have longer seasons to produce more bark beetles, and they're eating the forest down, and we're going to lose a lot of those beautiful forests from British Columbia on down, and just something new and different will grow, just as, you know, tiny little Japanese beetle is eating the hemlocks on the East Coast. Well, again, it's sad to see things that we love go down, but nature has constantly come up with new surprising arrays of replacements, and I'm not going to make a suggestion as to what the ecologists who are fighting a good fight to try to preserve some of the wonders that we have ought to do. I think that if there's a fight that can be won, it's probably worth a try. And every time we put up resistance to something, sometimes we preserve something that is worth keeping. But nature ultimately will take care of things.
Alan, thank you so much for being with us and spending all this time answering such a profound question in such a thorough way. It's just a fascinating book.
Well, these are all good questions, and I get a chance to ask a lot of very knowledgeable people what they thought about it, and it was a very rich experience, and I hope it's one that helps us figure out how to have our planet and keep us on it, too.
Right. Those are pretty important things to think about. Thanks, Alan. Alan Weisman, the book is The World Without Us, and it is published by St. Martin's Press. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for some 11 weeks now, and really has been compared to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It's a very important book, starting with the question, what would happen if we were just gone? What would happen? No human beings starting tomorrow for whatever reason, but the rest of the world would be around. What would happen? And he traveled all over the world to pristine forests, to the DMZ zone, to Cyprus, to the Amazon forest, to New York City, asking people that question. And it is it's really an extraordinary read. I guarantee you, you will be absorbed by it. Rhonda Fanning, producer of this program, and Bill Estes, who is our manager here in Milwaukee, are joining me in our studios to ask for your support. What a great book this is. You know, this is the kind of stuff that we talk about frequently, but this book is extraordinary in terms of the lengths that he went to answer that question.
Right.
And you can't help but think about all of your daily activities when you read something like that. It's just good.
Well, usually those discussions are framed in one particular instance. We talk about the climate, what would happen to plant and animal diversity, but everything is in this book. There's not one person he didn't talk to or one thought that he didn't. Oh, we're in a pledge drive.
We just get wrapped up in what we're talking about.
I hate to stop you from getting carried away here.
WPR.org, or give us a call at 800-383-9772. And for that $150 level, you will get a copy of this book, and you can continue the discussion.
Right.
Yeah, this last, 45 minutes of conversation is just a teaser for everything that's in this book. And for a pledge of, $12.50 a month, the book can be yours forever. So take about 2 minutes out of your day this morning, give one of our volunteers a quick call, and pledge your support to your favorite radio station. 800-383-9772 is the telephone number, or go to our secure website and pledge online anytime, WPR.org.
We do environmental issues frequently on this program, and we're happy to be able to offer this as a gift to you for your pledge of $150. And it's important information. You just don't, every time I do a pledge, I say this, but it is so true that you don't find these kinds of conversations anywhere. A chance to speak with Alan about this wonderful book, or ask these kinds of questions, or spend the rest of the day thinking about what would happen to your house if there weren't any more human beings here. I mean, that's an interesting way to spend a day, or to look at what's all around you and think, what if there weren't human beings here? What would survive? What wouldn't survive? And what steps do we need to take? It's an interesting way of looking at the. Well, I think you ought to pledge, is what I think. And the number to call is 800-383-9772. We have a goal of $3,000, and we're a bit short of it right now. This is the hour to get Alan Weisman's book, and would this be a great book for a book club discussion too? Don't you think, Brenda?
Yeah, for college students who are up late studying. I mean, it's just those kind of discussions that you have with friends and family. You're going to wish you had too. But if you call now and pledge at that $150 level, you will get Alan's book, The World Without Us. Log on to WPR.org. And Kathleen has said it, and I say it, I often find myself saying it over and over again, that this is very indicative of the type of programs that we have on Wisconsin Public Radio every day. These kinds of questions that are asked, and then we spend, a good hour going in depth looking for the answers. So if you enjoy this type of programming, keep it coming. WPR.org, there are those phones, or you can call 800-383-9772.
This is the first day, the first morning of our all-important fall pledge drive, and we come to you a couple times a year to talk directly to you to see if Wisconsin Public Radio is worthy of your support. If you appreciate the guests that Rhonda digs out and tracks down and researches for you every single day, if you appreciate the conversations that you tune into and eavesdrop on with Kathleen and her guests from the world of politics and science and medicine and, the list goes on and on and on. Put a dollar amount on that. Is that worth $12.50 a month to you and your family? If so, go to your phone. 800-383-9772 is the number. Pledge that $12.50 a month, and you'll receive with our compliments this fascinating book that you just heard about for 45 minutes. 800-383-9772.
Alan Weisman's book is The World Without Us. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for a long period of time, and it is an answer to the question, and he took this question pretty darn seriously. He imagined what would happen if the Earth's most invasive species, which is human beings, were suddenly and completely wiped out, and the book takes him all over the world and speaking with all kinds of people to come up with the answer to that. It is our gift to you at a $150 pledge this hour and only this hour, and I know you're going to love this book. I've talked to many of you for many, many years now, yep. And I know this is your kind of book. It's going to prompt all kinds of conversations. I started one, with my son last night saying, Andrew, do you know what's going to happen in New York City if there weren't any human beings? And it's the ideas. It's an extraordinary answer to a very interesting question.
Right.
And that's what we do all day. We do that.
In a different place. The one woman who called and said that she walks down the street now and sees a weed popping up out of the sidewalk and wonders, how long would it take for those weeds to completely devour that sidewalk.
Yes.
So get this book, $150 level, and you're going to start looking at the world, your house, your family, your pets, animals,
yikes,
all in a different light. $150, log on WPR.org or give us a call, 800-383-9772. Let's not have to imagine public radio without you, the listener.
Right. All questions large and small. That's what Kathleen and Rhonda bring to you every single day. These are some of the big questions to ponder, and you think, wow, what would the Earth be without all of us here? Interesting intellectual exercise. This book is available to you at the $12.50 per month level. Go to your phone right now. Call one of our volunteers. We ask for your name, address, a couple of phone numbers. Then we ask you how much you want to pledge and how do you want to pledge it. You can divvy it up into monthly installments, quarterly installments. You can put it on a Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or we can set it up between you and your bank where it comes silently, quietly out of your checking or savings account every month through electronic funds transfer. We're going to make this easy for you because we want you to help pledge your support and support this service. 800-383-9772.
And I like the question that you asked. It seems like a simple question when you said earlier, what would your life be without public radio? We say that on pledge drives, but when you ask that question in the context of this book and thinking in that way, think about it in a deep way. You would be missing all kinds of conversations. We have some extraordinary conversations with people you get a chance to talk to.
Right.
We're engaged in democracy. We're engaged in thinking big thoughts about a lot of issues of the day, and nobody else does that.
Right.
Our lives would be so diminished if we didn't have what we do every day. They just would be. I get excited coming to work every day and have for years and years and years and years and years now because of the nature of what we do. So,
So
call and pledge, 800-383-9772. I guarantee you, you're going to love Alan's book. If you can pledge it $150, we're going to send it to you.
That's right. Public radio, your constant source of news, voices, companionship, entertainment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we can be entertaining. So don't make us imagine public radio without you. Call now. Get this book. Alan, it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for going on 11 weeks now. I think it's 19 right now. It's one of the great, I think Bill McGibbon has described it as one of the grandest thought experiments of our time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fascinating, engaging book, and I think all of our listeners are going to love it. So call now.
You will. If you go to your phone right now, you're going to really appreciate this book. Read it, absorb it, talk about it, and pass it on to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the conversations going, not just today and tomorrow, but on into the future. Become a member of Wisconsin Public Radio and help pay for the service that you expect from Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-383-9772 or pledge online. We have a very secure website that's available to you. We never sell your name. We don't trade your name away. We don't give your name away. Once you become a member of Wisconsin Public Radio, your name is secure. We respect your privacy. Go to WPR.org. and pledge online.
And we only have about a minute left for this hour, so if you want to receive, most people pledge $150, receive this book, start a book club, you'll have great conversations. This conversation
amaze
will go on
friends.
And on and on and on. 800-383-9772. You need to pledge soon to receive a copy of Alan Weisman's The World Without Us. The World Without Us. Make them call, Rhonda. We got to say goodbye.
Or you can log
there,
on, WPR.org. You can continue, you can go to that website anytime. Or you can pledge through the break at 800-383-9772.
Thank you. Thanks for booking that, too. I love to do shows where you're just...
I got that book the day it came out. My copy is beaten up because I carried it with me everywhere.
Isn't it? It's fascinating, isn't it?
It
is absolutely
Maybe
fascinating.
Maybe I should call and get another one. Or I'll log on to WPR.org.
You have been reading a lot of it, haven't you? Yeah, it's real good. We got to say goodbye. Well, call, okay? Get the book, $150 for a pledge, 800-383-9772. And thanks all of you who have called and pledged so far. And so we have news coming up, and thanks, Rhonda, for producing the hour. John Treader, our great volunteer,
thanks
for answering phones. Thanks, John. News coming up, and we'll return here on the Ideas Network.